I'm John Batts with Bob Zimmerman. His book is Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, the first man flight to another world. 2.5 hours after the TV broadcast reading from Genesis is the trans-Earth injection. What is that, Bob?
This is where we get to the lack of redundancy on the STS engine. This is the moment Susan Borman dreaded the most. You know, they're in lunar orbit. They've got to fire the STS engine on the service module to speed up, leave lunar orbit, and head back to Earth. There is no redundancy on the STS engine. If it doesn't work, they're stuck in lunar orbit, and they're going to die there. Just imagine, science fiction of the ultimate, they would be run out of air. And, of course, they knew that if that was going to happen, they could just open the hatch and die quickly. But either way, they would die. So it had to work. And it was like going into lunar orbit as well. The burn of that engine would occur on the backside when the orbit was on the backside of the moon, which means no communications with the Earth. And so everyone knew they've been in lunar orbit for 20 hours. They're going around the moon, and it's near midnight on Christmas Eve, and they're circling around behind the moon. They disappear, and they're gone they're going to be out of touch for an hour. And sometime during that period, we know they're going to fire the engine.
Do the astronauts know about the firing? Can they hear it, Bob?
Remember, there's no air in space, but the engine is attached to their spacecraft. So when they fire the engine, they hear the vibration, but it's not like a roar. It's more like a buzz because it's coming through the body of the spacecraft. There's no atmosphere outside, so you don't hear a roar. So it's like a buzz, a vibration that they can hear.
On their instrument panel, is there a metric that tells them that it's fired correctly, that it's...
Yeah, when the engine, they set their computer using those numbers that were dictated to them to fire at the right time. Borman had his hand on the button so that he could, if the engine didn't fire, he'd press it himself immediately. And his hand was there to press the instant it was supposed to stop. And he pressed it the instant it was supposed to stop to make sure it would stop. He was doubling, protecting. He had a manual backup. And so they're there, and it's firing. And it fires, I think, I'd have to look at the book. You would probably maybe have the notes. It's about 2 minute firing. So they're sitting there waiting, listening. Everything sounds good. On Earth, we have no idea. The Capcom guy is just repeating Apollo 8. This is Mission Control. Do you hear me? Apollo 8, this is Mission Control.
Yes, yes. That's very dramatic, Bob. You know, is there anyone out there? Is there anyone out
there? Is there anyone there? And then suddenly, they, as expected, the loss of signal ends and they acquire the signal. And the first words we hear from Earth, from them on Earth are from Jim Lovell. And what Jim Lovell says is, and this is just 10 minutes after midnight, Christmas Day, he says, I want to report that there is a Santa Claus. And, of course, that tells everyone in the world that this engine worked and they're on their way back to Earth.
One more bump. Okay, they're exhausted. They sleep. They finally sleep without anxiety. Although there is that moment when, well, anyway, there's no anxiety. And we're coming along and they've got a crude computer and a crude navigation system. But it's functioned so far, except for, I'm not quite sure how he did it, but one of them, was it Anders, wiped out the navigation.
Lovell.
Wiped out the navigation details on their computer, and the craft could no longer orient itself. It was spinning.
Let me explain, John. Let me explain, because I know what's going on here. Jim Lovell was navigator. His job was to act as a backup to the computer. And the computer had a little gimbal ball that was supposed to tell its orientation from the moment at launch and how that orientation of the capsule changed throughout the whole mission. And the computer was doing this orientation work. But Lovell, during the mission, used a sextant and the stars to always be able to show he could back up orient the spacecraft if necessary. And at one moment on the way back, he suddenly is doing some stuff, and he says, uh-oh. And Borman says, uh-oh, I don't like that. And Lovell says, I think I've cleared the gimbal. So the gimbal now thought the spacecraft was on the launch pad at the beginning of the mission, basically set back to zero. And so what had to happen now is Lovell had to take out his sextant, use the stars to try to get the position that the orientation of the craft should be, and he proceeded to do so. He got us back into position.
Wait, Bob, it's more dramatic than this. First of all, he had a sextant? Sextant?
Yes, he was literally doing star readings, yeah, looking through the sky.
Where did
That's right. So, you know, just so you know, John, John, Hubble and spacecrafts use star guide stars to figure out where they are, and that's exactly what he was doing. The stars are always in a locked position, so if you can just identify specific stars, you can always get your orientation correct. And that's what he was doing.
Bob, he had a sextant as if he was on the deck of a sailing ship.
That's correct. And they did it on sailing ships, but in this case, he was using stars, which is actually easier to do, I think, than the sun, because the sun's a big, bright object. This is just a point source.
I'm making another point. I'm making another point, Bob. They put a sextant on board the most elaborate airship ever built, a spaceship. Yes. They put a sextant on board. Who thought of it? Whose idea was that? Do we know?
They had to make sure they had as many backups and redundancies as possible. I don't know who thought of it, but I can tell you right now they planned to make sure they had the redundancies they need. And they didn't know at this moment in time. This is the first time we're leaving Earth orbit. They didn't know if this gimbal computer system was going to work. So you go back to what has worked for 1,000 years, 500 years, Sexton and naval aviation, and Bohr Lovell was in the Navy. He knew how to do this. And so you go back to that, and you have it as a backup. It's going to work, and it did.
I was ready for them to pull up an abacus, All right. He's looking out one of the windows, and he has a very narrow vision, so he has to find a star. And the two I write down are Rigel and Sirius. He found them eventually. The other two members are sitting there with some anxiety. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. You better believe it. But, there's an interesting side note. Lovell had a nickname, which he didn't really like, but he had a nickname called Shaky, because things like this seem to happen, but he always was able to fix them. And this is an aspect of the astronauts in the 60s space race, especially. There was no human error of any consequence by any astronaut. Every decision they made in the end and every act they made was remarkably correct. And it's just a miracle of that entire 60s space program, how few errors occurred. And when they made a human error, they were able to always correct it. It's just astonishing. And this was another example.
Well, I have been writing down all the what-ifs. And at this point, I lowered their odds to 20-80.
The truth of the matter is, this is probably not that as significant a problem as other things.
Let's get to the next one. Double-skip trajectory.
That's right. All right. I was about to go to that,
Bob, explain what it is. Go ahead.
Okay, so they're coming back from the moon, and just like when they left, by the time they get close to the Earth, they're traveling 25,000 miles an hour. As Landis says, gleefully, years later, decades later, we still have the record for the fastest movement of any human on Earth. So they're going 25,000 miles an hour. They have to hit the Earth's atmosphere at the right angle so the atmosphere would act like like you're skipping a rock across a lake. They would bounce off the atmosphere, slow themselves down, then come down, and then drop into the atmosphere correctly at the right spot. And this is what's most amazing, how well this was done. They not only, and if the angle's a little bit off, try to skip a rock across the lake, they'll fly off into the into space, or they'll burn up in the atmosphere. But nope, they bounced perfectly, they came down, and they landed within three miles of where the ships were waiting.
How many times had this been done successfully before?
I think twice, once by the Russians and once by us. Oh,
it was another time I wrote down a what if, Bob.
That's right. And they did it. It worked.
Okay, at 30,000 feet, the first parachute goes. At 10,000 feet, the main chute goes. They hit the surface of the ocean and turn upside down and sink?
No, they just turn upside down. The capsule has a tendency to roll over. They fix this with balloons later on. They flipped. A lot of garbage fell on top of their heads. Borman threw up. The other guys who were Navy guys made fun of him, or Air Force guys, but either way, they were there at home and safe.
And the reason it was upside down,
It's top heavy. The capsule is top heavy.
And
so it rolls over.
When he hit the rafts, it flipped them back over.
Once they attach rafts and balloons.
It's nighttime, so they're rocking in the ocean, and the Navy won't get them till sunlight. How long were they there, rocking back and forth?
They landed at just before dawn, so it was about 30 minutes before they could come and get them.
However, the fact is that I marvel, Bob, at that 50-50.
Yeah, everybody does.
Bob Zimmerman. Yeah. He's the author of Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, the first manned flight to another world. I'm John Batchelor.